File 42. All the hopes that had been based on Russia were now lost. The ally who had sacrificed the most blood on the altar of their mutual interests had come to the end of his resources and lay prostrate before his unrelenting foe. A feeling of terror and dismay came over the Entente soldiers, who had hitherto been buoyed up by blind faith. They feared the coming spring, for, seeing that hitherto they had failed to break the Germans, when the latter could concentrate only part of the fighting strength on the Western Front, how could they count on victory now that the undivided forces of that amazing land of heroes appeared to be gathering for a massed attack in the West? The shadow of the events which had taken place in South Tyrol, the spectre of General Cadorna's defeated armies, were reflected in the gloomy faces of the Entente troops in Flanders. Faith in victory gave way to fear of defeat to come. Then, on those cold nights, when one almost heard the tread of the German armies advancing to the great assault, and the decision was being awaited in fear and trembling, suddenly a lurid light was set aglow in Germany, and sent its rays into the last shell-hole on the enemy's front. At the very moment when the German divisions were receiving their final orders for the great offensive, a general strike broke out in Germany. At first, the world was dumbfounded. Then, the enemy propaganda began activities once again and pounced on this theme at the 11th hour. All of a sudden, a means had come which could be utilized to revive the sinking confidence of the Entente soldiers. The probabilities of victory could now be presented as certain, and the anxious foreboding in regard to coming events could now be transformed into a feeling of resolute assurance. The regiments that had to bear the brunt of the greatest German onslaught in history could now be inspired with the conviction that the final decision in this war would not be won by the audacity of the German assault, but rather by the powers of endurance on the side of the defence. Let the Germans now have whatever victories they liked. The revolution and not the victorious army was welcomed in the fatherland. British, French, and American newspapers began to spread this belief among their readers, while a very ably managed propaganda encouraged the morale of their troops at the front. "Germany facing revolution! An Allied victory inevitable!" That was the best medicine to set the staggering Poilu and Tommy on their feet once again. Our rifles and machine guns could now open fire once again. But instead of effecting a panic-stricken retreat, they were now met with a determined resistance that was full of confidence. That was the result of the strike in the munitions factories. Throughout the enemy countries, faith in victory was thus revived and strengthened, and that paralyzing feeling of despair, which had hitherto made itself felt on the Entente front, was banished. Consequently, the strike cost the lives of thousands of German soldiers. But the despicable instigators of that dastardly strike were candidates for the highest public positions in the Germany of the Revolution. At first, it was apparently possible to overcome the repercussion of these events on the German soldiers, but on the enemy's side they had a lasting effect. Here the resistance had lost all the character of an army fighting for a lost cause. In its place there was now a grim determination to struggle through to victory. For according to all human rules of judgment, Victory would now be assured if the Western Front could hold out against the German offensive, even for only a few months. The Allied parliaments recognized the possibilities of a better future and voted huge sums of money for the continuation of the propaganda which was employed for the purpose of breaking up the internal cohesion of Germany. It was my luck that I was able to take part in the first two offensives and in the final offensive. These have left on me the most stupendous impressions of my life. Stupendous because now, for the last time, the struggle lost its defensive character and assumed the character of an offensive, just as it was in 1914. A sigh of relief went up from the German trenches and dugouts when finally, after 3 years of endurance in that inferno, the day for the settling of accounts had come. Once again, the lusty cheering of victorious battalions was heard, as they hung the last crowns of the immortal laurel on the standards which they consecrated to victory. Once again, the strains of patriotic song soared upwards to the heavens, above the endless columns of marching troops. And for the last time, the Lord smiled on his ungrateful children. In the midsummer of 1918, a feeling of sultry oppression hung over the front. At home, they were quarrelling.
About what?
We heard a great deal among various units at the front. The war was now a hopeless affair, and only the foolhardy could think of victory. It was not the people, but the capitalists and the monarchy, who were interested in carrying on. Such were the ideas that came from home, and were discussed at the front. At first, this gave rise to only very slight reaction. What did universal suffrage matter to us? Is this what we had been fighting for 4 years? It was a dastardly piece of robbery thus to filch from the graves of our heroes the ideals for which they had fallen. It was not the slogan, "Long live universal suffrage," that our troops in Flanders once faced certain death, but with the cry, "Deutschland über alles in der Welt." A small, but by no means an unimportant, difference. And the majority of those who were shouting for this suffrage were absent when it came to fighting for it. All this political rabble were strangers to us at the front. During those days, only a fraction of these parliamentarian gentry were to be seen where honest Germans foregathered. The old soldiers who had fought at the front had little liking for those new war aims of Messrs. Ebert, Scheidemann, Barth, Liebknecht, and others. We could not understand why, all of a sudden, the shirkers should abrogate all executive powers to themselves without having any regard to the army. From the very beginning, I had my own definite personal views. I intensely loathed the whole gang of miserable party politicians who had betrayed the people. I had long ago realized that the interests of the nation played only a very small part with this disreputable crew, and that what counted with them was the possibility of filling their own empty pockets. My opinion was that those people thoroughly deserved to be hanged, because they were ready to sacrifice the peace and, if necessary, allow Germany to be defeated, just to serve their own ends. To consider their wishes would mean to sacrifice the interests of the working classes for the benefit of a gang of thieves. To meet their wishes meant that one should agree to sacrifice Germany. Such, too, was the opinion still held by the majority of the army. but the reinforcements which came from home were fast becoming worse and worse, so much so that their arrival was a source of weakness rather than of strength to our fighting forces. The young recruits in particular were for the most part useless. Sometimes it was hard to believe that they were the sons of the same nation that sent its youth into the battles that were fought round Ypres. In August and September, the symptoms of moral disintegration increased more and more rapidly. Although the enemy's offensive was not at all comparable to the frightfulness of our own former defensive battles. In comparison with this offensive, the battles fought on the Somme and in Flanders remained in our memories as the most terrible of all horrors. At the end of September, my division occupied, for the third time, those positions which we had once taken by storm as young volunteers. What a memory! Here we had received our baptism of fire in October and November 1914. With a burning love of the homeland in their hearts and a song on their lips, our young regiment went into action as if going to a dance. The dearest blood was given freely here, in the belief that it was shed to protect the freedom and independence of the fatherland. In July 1917, we set foot for the second time on what we regarded as sacred soil. Were not our best comrades at rest here, some of them little more than boys? The soldiers who had rushed into death for their country's sake, their eyes glowing with enthusiastic love. The older ones among us, who had been with the regiment from the beginning, were deeply moved as we stood on this sacred spot where we had sworn loyalty and duty unto death. 3 years ago, the regiment had taken this position by storm. Now it was called upon to defend it in a grueling struggle. With an artillery bombardment that lasted 3 weeks, the English prepared for their great offensive in Flanders. There the spirits of the dead seemed to live again. The regiment dug itself into the mud, clung to its shell holes and craters, neither flinching nor wavering, but growing smaller in numbers day after day. Finally, the British launched their attack on July 31st, 1917.